Apparently, for the first 30 years of his life, Jesus lived a rather nondescript existence. There's nothing pointed out in the scriptures as being very significant about those earlier years of his life. Apparently lived quietly in Nazareth, involved in the occupation of being a carpenter, not taking any apparent leadership role of any kind. But when the time came in the will of God to assert himself and to present himself to the world as the Messiah of God, leadership became a hallmark of the rest of his life. In whatever circumstance Jesus was in, whether among friends or among enemies, whether among strangers, whether with those of high authority among men or those with the lower classes, in every situation, Jesus was undoubtedly a leader. Leadership comes in a variety of styles, and often the style is tailored to the objective in mind. There's the authoritarian style of leadership, maybe implemented by a drill instructor who's trying to take undisciplined young people and tear them back down to scratch and rebuild them in the image of the army or another military branch. There's the leadership style of expertise. This is not authoritarian. This is perhaps when you're in a foreign country and you've never been there before and the tour guide has, and he knows the language and he has the contacts and he knows where he's going and he knows the transportation and he holds up his umbrella and you follow along because he has the expertise. He's exercising leadership, but not in an authoritarian way. Then there's a motivational type leadership. This is what you might get from your diet or exercise coach. You voluntarily submit yourself to him or her because you see that there's value and knowledge and encouragement that's going to come from them to help you accomplish something in your life that you might not be able to do for yourself. Well, which of those leadership styles do you think Jesus might choose when he begins to assert himself? When he begins to make himself known as the Savior of men and the deliverer of the new covenant, the one who has the right, certainly, to command all men to do whatever he wants them to do, how is he going to lead? What style? What's the manner of the leadership? That's what I'd like us to focus on in the remainder of the lesson this morning. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 26. Jesus had access to absolute, complete, raw power. If there was ever someone who had the resources of pure authoritarian power, it was Jesus himself. In fact, in the hours immediately leading up to his death, at the hands of his enemies, those who thought by the appearance of things that they had totally taken control of Jesus' life, and they were herding him toward the outcome that they wanted, and that was to have him crucified. There was the appearance that they had all the power and he had none. But then in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 52, After Jesus is threatened now with arrest and Peter reaches out with a sword and cuts off Malchus's ear, Jesus said to him, "Put your sword in its place. For all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus?" I don't know all the theological implications of what Jesus says there, but I do think there's one point he's trying to get across to Peter in the main, and that is, they're not taking me because I can't do anything about it. They're taking me because I agree to it. I have the power to incinerate not only my enemies, but the entire universe, which he will exercise at one point in the future. But he says, they're not taking me because I can't do anything about it. I'm submitting myself to their activities for the greater good. And so Jesus has unlimited power, 12 legions of angels, limitless power to force whatever outcome he wants to force. As the Creator, Jesus could control all of the natural forces that he himself put in place. Not only could he call on heavenly forces, which is what he's saying here, he could call on and control any force in nature that he desired. And he demonstrates that by controlling the weather, by controlling animals, by controlling plant life, disease, even what he allowed for a certain period of time to be in this realm, the power of demons. Jesus demonstrates control over all of these earthly powers. In the case of demons, powers from another dimension, but demonstrated here upon the earth. Even death itself was under the control of Jesus. You know, Jesus is not like the mad scientist that you watch the old science fiction movies about, who creates the monster. And then the monster kind of takes control and becomes more powerful than the Creator and begins to run amok. And then finally the scientist is trying to get in the way of the monster to stop it. Louder I go, the louder they go. And then the scientist gets eaten up himself. You know, Jesus created all things and controls all things. Nothing happened that was outside of his power. And even when you look back throughout human history and you see the events unfolding with the Israelites and you see human powers like Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus, men who control the worlds of their day, the divine power overrode those men and at times, quite apart from their will, created certain outcomes. I wonder how tempting it would have been for Jesus to just simply take control of the situation and force whatever outcome he wanted to force. He had done it in history. All things were subject to his power. And yet that's not what we see. We don't see Jesus just forcing outcomes. We see Jesus controlling his power, moderating his power, so that the best outcome would be available to men. In John, the 10th chapter, where we were reading from just a little bit ago, would you turn there, your New Testament, John chapter 10. Larry mentioned the fact that Jesus explains himself and the Scriptures explain him in different ways, sometimes even apparently contradictory ways. I am the shepherd, but I am the sheep. Here it's, I am the shepherd, but he begins with, I am the door of the sheep. And they all have their application to the life of Jesus. But look at verses 11 through 15, John chapter 10. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But he who is a hireling and not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and I'm known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. Jesus did not come to capture by force the outward obedience of man. Rather, Jesus exercised power and exercised his leadership so that we might voluntarily submit ourselves to him. He did not come as a military occupier. You know, right in the heart of Jerusalem, in fact, right next to the temple in the fortress of Antonia, were Roman soldiers who actually, from that vantage point, looked down over the temple to make sure everything stayed in good order. And for Paul's sake, it was a good thing that they did, because they rescued him from a murderous Jewish mob in Acts chapter 21. The Romans were there as occupiers. The Romans were there to enforce obedience to the laws of Rome. Jesus didn't come in that sort of a leadership role. He came more as a proselyte. Could I use that term? He was a convert to humanity. He didn't just come and stand aloof and command, but he came to be one of us, a proselyte, and to influence us from within, if at all possible. And so, in 1 Peter chapter 5, the one that some religious people call the chief shepherd, in fact, I had a discussion this past week with a young man on the internet who called Peter the chief shepherd. But the one who some men call the chief shepherd writes here about shepherding. And he says in verse 4, after elders do their job among the people of God, when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. As Peter reflects on the life that Jesus had lived before him, and Peter had intimate knowledge and the ability to observe the leadership of Jesus while he was here on the earth, here's how Peter sums it up. He is the chief shepherd. Jesus came to lead us and guide us, we being the sheep, and he came to seek those sheep who were straying and tried to persuade them to want to come back. He came to conquer the heart of man, not merely enforce obedience. And so this is what we see when we consider the leadership of Jesus. Next, I want to consider with you three particular characteristics of this leadership. We could spend a lot of time on this, and I'd encourage you to use this as a springboard and go home and pursue this idea more on your own. There's other things that could be brought into the discussion about the leadership of Jesus, but three things in particular I want to share with you. Number one, Jesus demonstrates his shepherd leadership primarily by teaching. It is extremely difficult to talk about the life of Jesus and come to understand that life apart from the teaching that was such a central part of it. Teaching was just the natural outgrowth of the life of Jesus, and wouldn't you expect that from the Creator? Especially the Creator living among His creation and seeing it gone so awry. Wouldn't the natural inclination, at least of a loving shepherd leader, want to be to re-educate people about the way things are spiritually? They had lost sight of that. The way things are about ourselves. The way things should work in this world and the decisions that we should make and the basis that we should make those decisions on. Wouldn't you think it would be natural for the Creator to want to educate, to teach the creation that had gone so wayward? And so where do we see Jesus throughout His life? We see Him in synagogues. We see Him worshiping weekly as the people would come together to do so. We see Jesus when He's in the Jerusalem area, so often in the temple, teaching. In the heart of enemy territory, if you will. Teaching things that were diametrically opposed to those who saw themselves as being the teachers of the Jews. Jesus was in houses. Quite often in houses, and on sometimes social occasions. Sometimes in the houses of enemies. Those that invited Him in on false pretense. And He taught. Sometimes it was in a boat, because the crowds were crushing. Sometimes it was on a mountain, perhaps on a slope that provided some acoustical benefits when you had several thousand people assembled at His feet. He taught by the seashore. He taught when traveling through the fields. He taught while traveling. In essence, life for Jesus was tailored to teaching. Every place was an opportunity to teach. Every circumstance could be turned into a lesson. And Jesus drew lessons from everything around him. He drew lessons from creation. And among that creation which he had made, he taught about the care God had for the birds and the flowers. He taught about the clouds and what could be learned from atmospheric conditions. He taught about agriculture and made spiritual applications to simple farming. Sometimes Jesus looked at everyday people that were around him and drew lessons from them. Do you see that poor widow? Do you see what she threw into the treasury? Have you ever seen such faith as I see in this Roman centurion? I haven't seen such faith in all of Israel. There are stories Jesus told about human events. Somebody losing money and looking for it. Someone else being a victim of violence and the religious people passing him by. A rich man who dies and dies in an unprepared state. Foolish builders. All kinds of human circumstances are used by Jesus to convey spiritual lessons. And especially Jesus used the Scriptures. He appealed to the Old Testament in so many different ways, if not direct quotes, at least allusions to the Old Testament, pointing people back to the things that had already been revealed. What Jesus was trying to do, among other things, was move people away from the petty legalism that had overtaken them in their own day. The true meaning and substance, the heart of the law, had been gutted. And what was important to the religious minds of the day is that just slavish obedience be rendered, not to the law, but certain select parts of the law. And Jesus' approach was diametrically the opposite of that. Again, not to have men render slavish obedience, but gladly submit to the things of God, knowing the value of them. Jesus saw that the traditions of men had sapped the Old Testament of its true power. And he was trying to get people back to what the Scriptures actually said, and not the traditions and the explanations of men that in actuality neutralized the teaching of the law. And then we have this notation in Mark chapter 12 and verse 37. The common people heard him gladly. Common people were drawn to him because they understood him, because they saw the points he was trying to make, because those points had to do with real life. And so Jesus exercises leadership by teaching people. I was very stricken by what Danny Haynes presented to us, if you were here at 5 o'clock last Sunday afternoon, some pictures that he had taken from the area of Palestine. But I'd never envisioned the Sea of Galilee being small enough to be able to see a multitude of people walking along on the other side. And that just brought a whole new perspective to a number of things to me in understanding what Jesus did and how things sort of worked together in his life. But yes, some of those people could look across the sea and see the people were in mass moving in one particular direction. And you know what they were doing? They were following the shepherd. Where Jesus was going, the people were going, and some across the sea would see that and get in boats and start sailing across. The people were hearing him, and they were following him, and he was leading them because he was teaching about values. He was teaching about the anxieties of life. He was teaching about the concerns of real people and what they were having to deal with in their lives. And so his leadership was being demonstrated by teaching. And teaching as a shepherd. Teaching about the true concerns of the sheep. And the people were drawn to him. Secondly, Jesus demonstrated compassion. This might not be a quality that you would think about in a leader. You might not see it at work. You might not see it in the drill instructor. You might not see it in the football coach. You might not see it in any number of leadership capacities that we would think about. But sometimes you do. How moving is it when some of our citizens have lost their lives as soldiers or victims of violence, and you're watching on TV the funeral perhaps, and the President of the United States goes to people who are weeping and sorrowful. And you can just see these people dissolve because somebody as powerful and important as the President of the United States stopped, shook their hands, gave a kiss on the cheek, hugged them, and tried to express a common sorrow with them. We do at times see the element of compassion and leadership, but not often. And yet Jesus demonstrates to the ultimate degree compassion and leadership that draws people to Him. For example, in Luke chapter 7, Jesus demonstrates His capacity for compassion to those who are in sin. This is the example of Jesus being invited to the home of Simon the Pharisee under false pretenses. He had no desire to treat Jesus even in a very humanitarian way himself, to extend hospitality to Jesus, give Him the common courtesies of the day. He had ulterior motives in having Jesus in. And then in the middle of the interaction with Jesus, this sinful woman comes in from the outside, uninvited. But there's something about Jesus that draws her, and she's weeping at Jesus' feet and wiping His feet with her hair. She felt that Jesus was approachable. And in fact, He was, because He had compassion on those in their sins and demonstrates it in a number of other ways just besides that one. In John chapter 11, we find that Jesus shows compassion toward those who are in affliction, emotional affliction. This time it's with regard to Mary and Martha and the death of their brother. And rather than be some aloof, emotionally detached Creator who just simply can look down the road and see that Lazarus is going to be raised, and that being the case, perhaps having the tendency to just dismiss their emotions, that's not what Jesus does at all. Jesus wept along with them. He was deeply touched and deeply moved by what moved them. And again, demonstrates compassionate leadership. In regard to a whole city, Matthew chapter 23, verses 37 and 38, when people are doomed in their stubborn unbelief, rather than just pour forth an anger against them, Jesus rather pours out His compassion. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those that are sent to her, how often I would have gathered you to myself under my wings as a hen gathers her chicks. That is not a statement of anger, though Jesus was at times angry. It was a statement of heartbreak. Compassion for those who are stubbornly lost, who had rejected every overture of His leadership, demonstrated in the right way to draw men to Himself. And He said, I've tried to draw you. I've tried to draw you, but you wouldn't have it. And your house is going to be left to you desolate. If you would turn to Hebrews chapter 4, I think in these examples and in others that we could cite, what we see is what makes Jesus accessible to us, to all men, to the men that He lived among, to those of us that have not had the opportunity to physically be in His presence. Hebrews chapter 4, begin reading with me in verse 14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest, another one of these terms that describe Jesus, not here the chief shepherd, but the high priest. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. I've said before, Jesus becoming incarnate was not so that He could understand us. He already did that as the Creator. He understood us. His becoming incarnate was our confidence that He understands us. that we couldn't just look at him and dismiss him and say, you don't know a thing about it, you've not been here. Oh, yes, I have. I've been there. What's happening to you that troubles you? It happened to me worse. You try to think of something that you're going through, you have gone through, or you fear you're going to go through, and ask yourself, who's gone through a worse form of that? You or Jesus? And so we have a compassionate high priest. We have a caring chief shepherd who demonstrates his compassion on us in our sins when we've created the problem. In our afflictions, maybe when we haven't created the problem. Even in our doom, when we're walking apart from him, he's wishing us to come home. But in all of this compassion and all of this teaching and gentleness of spirit, we also have in Jesus a leader that was not afraid to rebuke. I'm going to put some statements up here that he makes to people. This is the interactive part of the sermon. You can participate, probably not out loud. That wouldn't be good. But just think in your own mind, can you identify to whom these things were said? Are you the teacher of Israel and do not know these things? That is rather pointed. Someone has come to Jesus and wants to interview him. And this is a man of stature among men regarding the law. And he asks a question that Jesus considers to be elementary. And Jesus answers and says, you mean to tell me you're the teacher and you don't know that? It's Nicodemus, John chapter 3 and verse 10. There were times when Jesus would zing you pretty good in order to try to get a point across and help you understand and help me understand what we weren't seeing, what they weren't seeing at the time. Here's what he said to somebody else. You worship what you do not know. You worship what you do not know. Do you ever want to say that to somebody? You've tried to study, you've tried to talk, you've tried to point out passages, and yet it's like chasing a rabbit all over the place. Hippity hop from one point to the other. You can't get them to focus on anything long enough, and yet they're fully convinced of what they believe. You worship what you do not know. Who did Jesus say that to? The woman in Samaria, in Sychar, John chapter 4 and verse 22. You are mistaken not knowing the Scriptures. It's rather blunt. This was in a religious discussion again. And the audience was trying to entrap Jesus, get him to be hung up in a theological contradiction. And at the end of the day, Jesus just says, you don't know what you're talking about. You're trying to talk about heavenly things and you don't know anything about it. You are mistaken not knowing the Scriptures. Who did he say that to? Matthew 22 and verse 29, he said it to the Sadducees. And then how about this one? O faithless and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long will I bear with you? The compassionate high priest? The gentle shepherd? Same person. Who does he say this to? Do you remember this occasion? Jesus has been on the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John, left the other disciples down the mountain. And a man brings his demon-possessed son, and they can't cast the demon out. And Jesus comes down from his great exaltation and triumph, if you will, on the mount, and he comes down to controversy and argumentation brought on by the weakness of his own disciples. And seeing their weakness and seeing the controversy and hearing the man who comes to him, whose son had not been healed as he desired, Jesus utters this statement to the disciples, to the scribes that were arguing, perhaps even to the man himself who had brought his son. And so what we see in Jesus really is a multifaceted leader. And in whatever way that he demonstrates his leadership, he's doing it for the good of the sheep. whether at times a pointed or harsh rebuke, whether at times to draw someone physically close and demonstrate compassion to them, whether to teach them wherever they were along the way. Jesus is the chief shepherd, the great leader of the souls of men. Jesus had courage, which obviously drew men to him. There was no situation that he was afraid of. Jesus demonstrated control. Every argument thrown at him, he could answer, and not only answer, could tie up his inquisitors at the same time. Jesus had knowledge and wisdom for every situation. He had confidence. How many times do we see Jesus telling the disciples not to fear? Nobody ever tells Jesus that. All of these things should draw us to Jesus because He is the kind of leader that we need for our souls. In demonstrating knowledge and compassion and care for us, even in our error and even in our sin, what Jesus is demonstrating is the kind of leadership that calls from us willing submission. It's interesting. Jesus, that I can see in the Scriptures, never chases anyone down who walks away from Him. He doesn't beg. He doesn't plead. He simply demonstrates Himself as God in the form of a man, and then gives everyone the choice to follow Him, to obey Him. And so what we find is in Jesus as a leader, all of the reasons to come to Him and submit. What we find in Jesus as a leader also is an example for us as parents, elders, preachers, teachers, and perhaps even those in the middle of your secular work world, the kind of leadership skills that you might even display on the job. What we see is an example of someone who tries to evoke willing followership. He wanted the sheep to want to come home. And as we lead in our families, we want to lead in such a way that causes our children to want to follow us as parents. We don't want to try to coerce our children, force them, pester them, manipulate them into obedience. We want them to love us and respect us and follow us because they're choosing to do so. Forgive me if I told the parakeet story before. After a while, you don't remember what story you should tell where. When I was a boy, I would suppose about 6 or 7. It was early, but it sure made an impression on me. Our parakeet got out. You remember the old, if you've lived in the South long enough, you know, remember the sound the screen door would make when it had the spring, and then it would slam back? Well, I don't know. Maybe the parakeet figured out what that sound was all about because he heard the spring opening one day, and boy, he was gone, flew out. Well, this was major distress to the family. We were all in a state, and we all went out, and we were calling Pete. Okay, Pete the parakeet. We were calling Pete. Because we knew Pete was toast. If he was out among the blue jays and the crows and everything else, you know, this was a domesticated bird. He had no chance at all. But I remember we just spent a good part of the day in a panic trying to find Pete. Well, I guess Pete didn't want to come home. So what we did was we propped the screen door open and just went about our business during the day, rather vainly hoping Pete would find his way home.